been a friend, someone who needed to talk. I looked out the window. The street was empty, dead, like I'd never seen it. Nothing but papers blowing down the street. You know how, every time you see a scrap of paper now, you think it's from the Trade Center? For a minute, I thought I saw something move. But when I looked again, there was nothing. I didn't ring the buzzer, but it seemed someone upstairs did, because I heard this noise, a rustling in the hall. When I went to the door and lifted the spy hole, this figure stood there on the landing, looking around like she was lost. She wore a dress, long and torn, and a blouse, what I realized was a shirt waist, turn-of-the-century clothes. When she turned towards my door, I saw her face. It was bloody, smashed like she had taken a big jump or fall. I gasped, and then she was gone.
And you woke up?
No, I tried to call you. But the phones were all screwed up. She had fallen, but not from 100 stories. Anyway, she wasn't from here and now. Mags had emptied the carafe. I remember that she just had ordered a salad and didn't eat that. But Angelina brought a fresh carafe. I told Mags about the family at the barricades. There's a hole in the city, said Mags. That night, after we had parted, I lay in bed.
You are listening to the recorded reading of There's a Hole in the City, read for you by Rick Bowes, Richard Bowes, who is here with us in the studio. But this is the recording that we made in early 2006 and has been broadcast on BAI, both on the 5th and 10th anniversary of September 11th. We're also going to do it this year, the whole story. And now what we are going to do, this being a fundraiser, is I'm going to move to about, 5 minutes before the end of the story and fade in so that you get the denouement. But may I strongly suggest that if, I'm sorry?
Order,
yes. Okay, I'm sorry. You will call. You will pledge. My name is Freund. Und. Well, that's a Jewish name, but it's still German. You should have heard some of my few remaining relatives. By the way, it's now 1:30 in the morning, and therefore this is Hour of the Wolf at this point.
Aru.
Aru, indeed. And let me say that not long after this also, we're going to actually do a part of the Hour of the Wolf show in a movie review, which is a segment that Dan Persons does for us. And he's been off so long, he's reviewing like 2 or 3 movies. But anyway, at this moment, what we're going to do is we're going to listen to the denouement of the story so that you have an idea where it's going. If you want to hear the damn thing uninterrupted, well, we'll have it September 11th. But besides
it can be yours.
It can be yours. You can own a copy. And it's well worth owning, along with, and this is something that we're not broadcasting now, the discussion with Charles Strozier that followed between Rick Bowes and myself and Charles Strozier on the meaning of the story and the concept of how people survive huge tragedy involving masses of people and the effect that that has upon individuals. Right now, go to the website, give2wbai.org, or call area code 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602.
GIV2.
GIVBAI. GIVE2.
GIVE2.
WBAI. We beg at intervals, except that the intervals are becoming more. We beg always incessantly.
Well, you know.
.org. And
it's an old profession.
For $40, you will get the entirety of this recording plus that discussion with Charles Strozier. For $75, 5 people, and this is limited to 5 people. For all I know, if we're lucky, they're already gone, but you'll find that out on the website.
You can only find that
out. For $75, you can get a copy, an autographed copy of the book from whence the story is finally appeared under Rick's name, as opposed to the website that it first appeared on, Ellen Datlow's website, and it's been anthologized, but is now part of a novel. And that novel is Dust Devil on a Quiet Street. And for $75, you can get both. So now we're going to move on to the closing of the story, so you have an idea of where it is going.
I rang Super's apartment. She was a neighborhood lady, a lesbian around my age. I asked her about Mags. She disappeared. Last time anyone saw her was Sunday, 9-9. People in the building checked to make sure everyone was okay. No sign of her. I put a tape across her keyhole Wednesday. It's still there. I saw her just yesterday. Yeah? She looked skeptical. Well, there's a World Trade Center list of potentially missing persons, and her name's on it. You need to talk to them. This sounded to me like the landlord trying to get rid of her. For the next week, I called Mags a couple of times a day. At some point, the answering machine stopped coming on. I checked her building regularly. No sign of her. I asked Angelina if she remembered the two of us having dinner at her place on Wednesday 9-12. I was too busy staying busy so I wouldn't scream. I remember you, and I guess you were with somebody. But no, honey, I don't remember. Then I asked Marco if he remembered the phone call, and he did, but was much too involved by then with Terry and Eloise to be really interested. Around that time, I saw the couple who had wanted to take their kids down to Ground Zero. They were walking up 6th Avenue, the kids cranky and tired, the parents looking disappointed, like the amusement park turned out to be a ripoff. Life closed in around me. A short story collection of mine was being published at that very inopportune moment, and I needed to do some publicity work. I began seeing an old lover who'd come back to New York as a consultant for a company that had lost its offices and a big chunk of its staff when the North Tower fell. Mrs. Pirelli did not come home from the hospital, but went to live with her son in Connecticut. I made it a point to go by each of the Arab shops and listen to the owners say how awful they felt about what had happened, and smile when they showed me pictures of their kids in Yankee caps and shirts. It was the next weekend that I saw Mags again. The university had gotten permission for the students to go back to the downtown dorms and get their stuff out. Marco, Terry, and Eloise came by the library and asked me to go with them, so I volunteered. Around noon on Sunday, 9-23, a couple of dozen kids and I piled into a university bus driven by Roger, a Jamaican guy who has worked for the university for as long as I have. The day before 9-11, these kids didn't much want old farts keeping them company, Roger had said to me. Then they all wanted their daddy. He led a convoy of jitneys and vans down the FDR Drive, then through quiet Sunday streets, then past trucks and construction vehicles. We stopped at a police checkpoint. Cop looked inside and waved us through. At the dorm, another cop told the kids they had an hour to get what they could and get out. Be ready to leave at a moment's notice if I tell you to, he said. Roger and I, as the senior members, stayed with the vehicles. The air was filthy. Our eyes watered. A few hundred feet up the street, a cloud of smoke still hovered over the ruins of the World Trade Center. Piles of rubble smoldered. Between the pit and us was a line of fire trucks and police cars with cherry tops flashing. Behind us, the kids hurried out of the dorm carrying boxes. I made them write the names on the boxes and noted in which van the boxes got stowed. I was surprised, touched even, the number of stuffed animals that were being rescued. Over the years, we've done some weird things to earn our pensions, I said to Roger. Like volunteering to come to the gates of hell? As he said that, flames sprouted from the rubble. Police and firefighters shouted and began to fall back. A fire department chemical tanker turned around, and the crew began unwinding hoses. Among the uniforms, I saw a civilian, a middle-aged woman in a sweater and jeans, carrying a sign. Mags walked toward the flames. I wanted to run to her. I wanted to shout, "Stop her!" Then I realized that none of the cops and firefighters seemed aware of her, even as she walked right past them. As she did, I saw another figure, thin, pale, in the suede jacket and bell-bottom pants. He held out his bloody hands, and together they walked through the smoke and flames into the hole in the city. Was that them? Marco had been standing beside me. I turned to him. Terry was back by the bus watching Marco's every move. Eloise was gazing at Terry. "Be smarter than we were," I said. And Marco said, "Sure," with all the confidence in the world. There's a Hole in the City by Richard Bowes, read to you by the author.
So, hopefully that taste, the beginning and denouement, the end of the story, gives you an idea of just what is going on. And that is also, as we said, the opening chapter of Dust Devil in a Quiet Street. And if you donate $75 to WBAI, you will get a copy, an autographed copy of the book, as well as the complete reading of There's a Hole in the City, as well as the on-air discussion that occurred on the 10th anniversary of September 11th. 2011 was the precise date that that occurred, along with Charles Strozier. And we have Rick Bowes, the author, here. If you just want the CD alone, that's a $40 pledge. If you want the CD and the book, there are only 5 copies of the book, so you need to act quickly on that now. That's for a $75 donation, and it's a website. It's GIVE, numeral 2, WBAI.org, or the telephone number to call and pledge in order to get this is 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602. But or you can actually just go to WBAI.org, if you can't remember the Give To part, and you will be able to go through to where you donate, and you choose your favorite show, which is, of course, Hour of the Wolf, which is what you are listening to. And you make that donation, you tell WBAI a couple of things. Number one, we want WBAI to survive. Number two, we want Hour of the Wolf to survive, or something close to it. And you will be sending that signal by making that pledge. And number three, you'll be doing yourself a favor, assuring the continued survival of a radio station which is a unique. There's nowhere else where you can hear the kind of programming that we have done through the years that we're going to change, because change will occur or else we will not survive. It's very simple. People can say, I hear rhetoric from so many people, "You want to throw away the listeners?" No, we want to serve the listeners. We want to serve them better. And in order to do that, we need to pull our resources together, get into a huddle, and figure out how that is going to happen. And in order for that to happen, you need to pledge so that there will be the money to pay the transmitter, to pay the rent, so that we can move to 388 Atlantic Avenue, and we can pay the rent here at City College, which is a nice space and less expensive space, but it's not a free space. We're also paying for the storage of all the equipment that we had at 120 Wall Street. There are tape recorders and all kinds of hardware that are required to run a radio station, much of which is still not available to us now. All of that needs to happen, and the only way that's going to happen is, number one, if we survive, and number two, if we have the money to rebuild. Please make that call now. Or go to that website now. I think the website is actually the easier way to do it. Give numeral 2 WBAI.org, or if you're not web friendly, don't have access to the web immediately, then call area code 516-620-3602. $40 for the CD of There's a Hole in the City, $75 for the book Dust Devil in the Quiet Street, plus the CD. and that's limited to 5 people. And as I say, I don't actually have any way of knowing when that is gone. So for all I know, it's already gone. I can actually pray and hope that it's already gone. Something tells me it isn't. Make the call now and support WBAI. Should we go, Rick, to the movie review? Or there was an afterword that you wanted to say, right?
Well, I was going to. I have a couple of pieces that I could read, but you can put on the movie review.
Why don't we do the movie review and okay. Then go to what you read. But I think also it's important, you were telling me off air, that Mags and some of the characters continue through the novel.
They do, yes. The characters from the first chapter, yes. What they were like together when they were kids, and then they haunt the narrator and show up in various inappropriate places throughout the book.
Yeah.
And that basically is how it ends. He reconciles himself.
To that happening, yeah.
To them, you know, that... That they're gone and that, you know, they're not going to, that they haunt him, but not, you know, severely.
Yeah, it's a state of being. It's a way of trying to cope and understand the unfathomable, which is their loss.
Right. Death.
So,
yeah.
Exactly. So, people think of science fiction, fantasy, spec fic, whatever it is you want to call it. People think of it as, you know, just a storytelling technique, a way to go, ooh, booga booga. It's not that when it's done well. There is subtext, there is meaning, there are life lessons. And beyond life lessons, as it were, in the best of this stuff. And I think that the writing of Richard Bowes is one of the best ways to do that, which is why Rick is so often on the show. And, oh, by the way, going to be reading at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which I produce along with the great Michael Swanwick, on September 10th.
That's right, when we will all have recovered from the summer and Labor Day.
And the day after, Hour of the Wolf will be back with the entire reading of There's a Hole in the City.
Right.
Yes, it had not gone past me. Yeah. And by the way, September 10th, in 2001, there was a reading of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And I don't remember who the first reader was. The second reader was F. Gwynplaine
McGlynnamushuminga.
That's it. A very, very strange dude.
Even by the standards of speculative fiction writers, he was very odd.
He really was. And he horribly killed himself in a fire. Of his own causing. Causing other apartments and people to be harmed.
And died in agony
By his own choice.
Yeah.
And on September 10th, I was waiting for the reading. I think that one was curated by Cherie Renee Thomas. Or Carol Cooper. It was one of those two folk. At any rate, I spent waiting for the location, which at that point was the Vineyard Theater.
That's right, the Vineyard Theater, where I did the smallest reading I've ever done. That was me and another reader and a listener.
That's right. But I was there.
You were there, but you weren't a listener.
No, I was recording.
So it
exists. But anyway, I spent before that reading in the Borders bookstore in the World Trade Center about 14 hours before the towers fell. No, more like 16 hours before. And then I went from there direct to the reading and
McGillicum Gumblack name.
Yes. was doing a reading and fainted in the middle of the reading, fell to the floor insensate in the middle of the reading, and got up and he was perfectly fine. And I think it was feigned.
Well, everything else about him was, so I don't see why that wouldn't have been.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just a bag of self-invention.
Yeah, and the story wasn't very particularly good either.
No, that was the other thing. He wasn't a very good writer.
No, he really wasn't.
No.
Yeah. But anyway, on to a segment of Hour of the Wolf that is usually here. Dan Persons has been doing mainstream reviews. Before we had Genevieve Valentine, who was doing independent movie reviews, and she's on hiatus from that for by her choice for an indetermined amount of time. But in the but whether or not she returns to that, Dan Persons is doing what we would call the tentpole movies, the movies that will make or break the studios that spend the hundreds of millions of dollars on them. So here is catching up the latest of several movie reviews. Take it away, pre-recorded Dan.
I'm Dan Persons, movie critic for Hour of the Wolf. Hey, how about them monsters, huh? We got three variations on the theme here, and that's good because
you like monsters. Everybody likes monsters. Everybody likes the Wolverine. He's a kind of a monster. Guy who wants to do good but is always walking on that line. And he's also one of the most popular characters in the Marvel roster, which made it particularly ironic that his previous solo outing, X-Men Origins Wolverine, was one of the least popular films featuring a Marvel superhero. They're trying again here with a film simply titled The Wolverine, bringing back Hugh Jackman to star, bringing in James Mangold to direct. He did a quite good remake of 310 to Yuma and the not-so-good Tom Cruise spy comedy Night and Day. And they're doing this as a simple, standalone adventure with a bit of continuity blended in, where Logan, a.k.a. Wolverine, finds himself in Japan protecting an heiress and battling Yakuza and Ninja, and all the stuff that you'd expect from Wolverine in Japan. And that's the film shortfalling. There's a good opportunity here, a nice contrast, the feral Logan tossed in the midst of this rigid, structured society, and it never really gets there. They go for a lot of high-level, easily recognizable elements, Ninja and Yakuza, bullet trains, World War II, but there's no sense that the understanding goes deeper than pop culture level. More, Logan never really feels fully integrated into the corporate power struggle. That's the central conflict of the film. This is another case where the main character feels like a guest star in his own story. Mangold does pull off some neat action sequences. A battle on top of bullet train takes the old cliche and works some new twists on it. But this is, at best, a dutiful entry in the Marvel movie catalog. You want your Wolverine, you got him, but it's hardly memorable. So, Wolverine is a monster who needs a little love, and that could well be said of Jeff Burton, who, as played by Michael Eklund, is the main character of Errors of the Human Body, a new film coming up on home video. He's a geneticist who, after the death of his infant son from a rare and horrifying genetic mutation, hooks up with a lab in Germany to try to develop a cure, a goal so noble, you know it's going to go wrong. And what with Jeff reconnecting with a former intern with whom he had a romantic liaison, and his stumbling onto a secret experiment that attempts to transfer the regenerative abilities of reptiles into mammals, and him getting bitten by one of the test mice of that experiment, you know what kind of toll that's going to take on the guy who's on the righteous mission. Let's just say he ain't happy when he looks in the mirror. The director here, Aaron Sheehan, who also co-wrote the script, occasionally goes for set pieces that are visually striking, even if they don't make much sense to the story. Just because you're in Germany doesn't mean you have to visit the loud Eurotrash nightclub or make it a costume party on top of that. But his strength is in tracing the descent of Jeff as he succumbs to his very human foibles. Even more impressive is how Sheehan manages to hold to the film's final minutes just how much of a monster Jeff actually is, and remarkably, how understandable and affecting that revelation is. It's those last chilling moments that really sold Errors of the Human Body for me. There's also a revelation at the end of the science fiction film Europa Report. Does it involve a monster? Let me dodge that question and instead posit that, like Errors of the Human Body, the monster here may not be some snarling, drooling man-beast, but human hubris, although in this case the hubris is not quite of Dr. Frankenstein, we are tampering God's domain grade, but more on the order of the admirable compulsion to push past established boundaries into the unknown, accepting that the unknown may well push back hard. It's the story of a disastrous manned mission to the Jupiter moon Europa, launched to search for signs of life off Earth. Director Sebastian Cordero uses the found footage approach here. The bulk of the story is told through monitoring cameras scattered about the spacecraft. It works better than it has in the recent batch of Paranormal Activity sequels, but Cordero keeps things plausible. There's more than a few echoes of 2001 A Space Odyssey to the scenario, both stylistically and to the extent that Cordero consulted with experts at places like JPL and NASA to make life on board the spacecraft and the crushing sense of time that accompanies it quite believable. Occasionally, Cordero gets too cute with how he displays his video footage, fast framing through multiple cameras like someone flipping quickly between TV channels or putting up a dozen feeds on screen at once. But that's just a minor quibble about a film that refreshingly tells a genuine science fiction story that makes us feel for the perils encountered by its crew, which includes Charlton Copley and Michael Nyquist, and that leaves us, like 2001, somewhat awestruck in its revelations, albeit with slightly less metaphysical overtones. At the moment, Europa Report stands as the best fantastic film I've seen this year, a humble yet well thought out and executed foray into genuine science fiction storytelling. It's as rare as finding single cell organisms off world, and all the more welcome because of it. I'm Dan Persons. You can check out more about the world of fantastic film over at CineFantastique Online at cfqonline.com.
So that was Dan Persons. Well, he told you that himself. And hopefully we'll be back to a normal schedule next week. Next week on Hour of the Wolf, by the way, Chandler Klong-Smith. You've met her, Rick, haven't you?
Yeah, I believe I have.
Yeah, yes. And you were asking me earlier, Karen Hewler, they're always sitting together. That's how you can tell who Karen is. I spoke for Karen's class at NYU yesterday. I had a lovely, Barbara and I both did. We had a great time. I don't think, very modern building at NYU on Thompson Street. 238 Thompson Street.
Well, it's a recent acquisition, I guess.
I believe it is.
Yes.
Oh, it's ultra-modern.
Sooner or later, they'll own everything.
Yeah, well, that's there. Well, we're here at CUNY, though, right now at CCNY. This is, by the way, WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and over WBAI.org. My name is Jim Freund. This is a fundraising edition of Hour of the Wolf, not raising money for Hour of the Wolf, but raising money for WBAI. And with me is Richard Bose, a.k.a. Rick, and but the byline is Richard, who has not one, but two new books out, three books out.
Oh, four. Three new ones
and a
reprint.
There's the fairy tale book.
There's the fairy tale book. It's called The Queen, the Cambion, and Seven Others, and it is an illustrated fairy tale book.
Yeah, as fairy tale books ought to be.
And it's...
lovely edition. I really...
It's Rackham and Doré illustrations. And yeah, it's a beautiful little book. I published quite a few books, and this in many ways is my favorite.
Really?
It's the only one with illustrations.
Yeah, and the simple fact that it's fairy tales for me is such a wonderful thing, because I think fairy tales are at the core of imaginative literature.
Well,
Holding two books open at the same time.
Myth is the sea on which the fantasy story floats. Legend is the wind that drives it. And its place of birth is the fairy tale.
Who wrote that?
Me.
Ah, I thought I knew you were quoting somebody I liked. And another book just out within the last month, Dust Devil in a Quiet Street, which listeners can get an autographed copy by going to the WBAI.org and pledging, and look for Richard, it's called on the webpage, Richard Bowe's Dust Devil, and you can get a copy of the book and the entirety of the short story you just heard, There's a Hole in the City, which is included in the book. And the other book that's about to come out, Rick, is...
My last book for the year is going to be If Angels Fight, and it's short stories from the first one that I had published, which was On Death and the Deuce, which came out in fantasy and science fiction in 1992. And the title story, If Angels Fight, is a World Fantasy Award-winning story, and it's about Boston, mainly. Some of it is set in New York, but mainly it's about Boston, and it's about politics, which in the Boston I grew up in, which was the Boston of the 1950s...
They were inseparable.
Well, it was what people's fathers did. You know, it was... And it was very strange, you know, like, what does your dad do? Well, he's the Speaker of the House, you know. It was just... It was very odd, and people went to jail.
What did your dad do?
What did my father do? Yes. Well, that's interesting. When I was a very small child, he had just come back from World War II. Before that, he had been in the theater, and he was for a while after that. And then he became a teacher, and he organized a teachers' union in Boston, which got him into amazing amounts of trouble.
Unions
will do that. But then he became an editor of textbooks, and then, in his final days, he wrote textbooks. And the writing of the textbooks was an amazingly profitable thing. You would simply not believe how much money there is in that. He and my mother owned half of 1% of the royalties of a social studies book that Houghton Mifflin put out, and they made, over the course of the years, $1 million out of it.
Oh, my God.
Yes, so that apparently...
I would never have guessed.
It was quite strange. I mean, through no fault of my own, I collect more royalties from Houghton Mifflin at this point than I do from my own stuff.
That's...
Disgusting, I know, but yes, it is. But anyway, yes, that was what he did. And I have a story about that will be in the magazine The Revelator, which is put out. Yes. And it's not a speculative fiction story. It's just what it was.
Yeah, The Revelator is a weird magazine. I encountered it for the first time at ReaderCon.
It is indeed very strange. It's Matt Chaney and Eric, oh, dear God, Fischel. And... yes, they are devoted to putting out this very weird magazine, and
I have to have them on the air to talk. I've never had Matt Chaney on the show, and I've always meant to.
Well, that should be interesting, and talk about the book.
I just edited a horror story which just came out actually online at nightmaremagazine.com, and do not listen or read that story within 3 hours of a meal. If you want to keep that meal, let me just tell people that. It's a horror story, and it's...
Disgusting.
It is. It really is.
There's nothing like a nice, disgusting story. I've always said that.
Yes. And on that note...
I shall read. This is a story that originally I wrote for The Mumpsimus, which is Matt Chaney's website. In June, for the 40th anniversary of the event, the Stonewall Riots, an old friend asked me to reminisce about them for his blog. It's a last-minute request, but a title and opening paragraph came to me immediately, and the assignment gave me immense pleasure. I wrote, "In history's vicinity, it's odd to be old enough to remember history. The Stonewall Riot always makes me feel like a citizen of Concord, awakened by musket fire on that crisp April morning, and wondering what the commotion was. Writing this took me back to the New York City of the 1960s. I wrote about walking down Third Avenue with its bird bars, gay bars, discreet cruising, passing through the world-famous Chicken Run at 53rd and Lex, with its boy hustlers hanging around coffee shops. Bars in the street pretty much delineated gay life back then. The first gay bar I ever went to was one in Boston called, maybe, the Sugar Bowl. I was 16, and the drinking age there was 21. They wouldn't serve me, but didn't care if guys gave me their drinks. The Sugar Bowl was also the first place I got tossed by the cops. I'd been slapped around once or twice for loitering when nice boys didn't venture, but this was a raid, and a cop gave me a bloody nose. He let me go when I gave him the name of an uncle of mine who was on the force. My life was hell when I got home. Compared to Boston, everything in New York was big and open. It was like everyone in the city knew what boys did at 53rd and 3rd. In Boston, it was all dark corners and whispers. Those bars, those coffee shops, were criminal enterprises subject to police raids and being shut down. The men cruising and the boys loitering could be arrested on a whim. Serving minors, serving as a place where minors could be had for cash, was no bigger a crime than catering to a gay clientele. Mark Crowley's The Boys in the Band was the first American play to deal overtly with gay life and the kind of men who drank at the bird bars. It opened on April 15, 1968. By the time the movie came out in 1970, its world of gay self-hatred and closeted sex looked like a period piece. Between the play and the movie's opening, the Stonewall Riot had occurred. If I'd known the Stonewall was going to become an historic site, I'd have paid more attention. In fact, it was one bar among many. Gay kids poured into Greenwich Village from all over the city, the country, the world. The nation was all on fire, and every oppression but ours got protested. The Stonewall Inn was badly ventilated, crowded, and filthy. The toilets were an abomination. The bartenders were hostile, and the drinks were watered. But that was true in all the village gay bars. Manhattan ran on methadrine, and speed was easily obtained there. The drags danced like furies. The crowd was young. The scent was beer, sweat, and amyl nitrate and cheap cologne. Mags couldn't stand the place. Jeff and I put on a show of ennui, but we shared a fascination. He wouldn't go there unless I went with him. Until I wrote the article, I'd forgotten that. My grandfather from Ireland used to say that if every man who boasted he'd fought at the Easter Rising in 1916 had actually stood in the Dublin post office, James Connolly and Padraic Pearse would be sitting in Buckingham Palace at the moment he spoke. In my case, around 3 o'clock on that famous Saturday morning, I was walking down St. Mark's Place with Jeff, looking for the bug boy. Mags was elsewhere. A kid we both knew rushed up and gave us a garbled story about the Stonewall. That's when we became aware of distant sirens. In that time and place, civil disturbances were what bullfights were to Hemingway's Madrid, and we were all aficionados. The kid ran off to spread the news. Jeff and I headed west, crossed Astor Place, and went down 8th Street, which was still the heart of the village. The book and music stores were dark, but the bars were just closing. The after-hours clubs were opening. The street was full of people, all looking west. Near the corner of 6th Avenue was what we recognized as the rear area of a riot. In the doorway of Nathan's, a blonde kid in short shorts and mascara held a bloody towel to his forehead, and a friend held him. From the upper floors of the massive, darkened women's house of detention across the avenue, some inmates were yelling, "The pigs are killing all the faggots!" Police cars, with flashing cherry tops, barred the way. All along 6th Avenue, firemen hosed down piles of burning trash. Paddy wagons and tactical patrol buses were parked too deep, and the riot cops were angrier than I ever saw them. Here, coherent memory breaks down. From Sheridan Square, I looked down Christopher Street and caught a glimpse of the front of the Stonewall Inn. Broken glass was everywhere. A car had been turned on its side. A lot of us discovered how angry we were that weekend. Jeff amazed me. He was red-faced, furious, spitting out, "Kill them," every time cops rode by. The riot had broken down into guerrilla tactics, roving bands of kids chanting slogans, burning trash. I heard people shouting from the windows at the cops to go away. I saw a cop smash a club across the back of a guy who I think was just coming home with groceries, and smash him again when he dropped his bags. That did it. Too much speed in his system, a short lifetime of swallowing insults and accumulating anger. Jeff moved toward the cop and his partner. I grabbed him, threw him against a parked car, and dragged him down a side street before the police came after us. I concluded my piece. By Monday, it was over, but as with 9/11, decades later, events in this tumultuous city, in that time of war and turmoil, began to be defined as having happened before Stonewall or after. And it was kids, like the ones at 53rd and 3rd, not the Suit Johns in their uptown bars, who had given us those nights. Men with powdered hair and silk breeches could have signed declarations and petitions to King George forever. But on that Concord morning, it was men and women, not the most attractive or socially poised, not with the purest of motives or the loftiest of intents, people like me, and perhaps like you, who found themselves pushed, one unendurable time too many.
Wow.
That was a story I had no idea was in me.
Really?
And I got that, you know, he asked.
When did you write that?
68. It was 2008. It was the 40th, or 2009, the 40th anniversary of Stonewall.
Of the riot, yeah.
Yeah, and I had, like, it was going to go up on Sunday, and he asked me on Thursday, and I wrote. The story I did for him is a bit different than the one I just read out of Dust Devil, mm-hmm. but basically the same. What I had done...
You've tweaked these short stories that you wrote individually in
right.
order to work them into the mosaic that is the fix-up.
That is the fix-up, yes. That is the mosaic novel, yes.
That is the mosaic novel.
Right.
That's exactly it.
Right. What I had done in the book, there's a scene towards the beginning of Dust Devil in which the narrator is walking back. He's going to a psychiatrist in New York. He's like 21 at that point. And he needs to see a psychiatrist because he's at a school where there is compulsory ROTC, and he has dropped out of ROTC, and he needs basically a psychiatrist note. And the way down back to Penn Station, because he goes to school and he lives out on Long Island, it's down. He goes down 3rd Avenue past the Bird Bars, which are gay bars. And
the Bird Bars, I'd never heard that.
Flamingo, the Golden Parrot, they all had birds' names. And it was all very discreet.
I knew those places because WBAI was located
nearby.
On 62nd and First.
Right.
So I knew that neighborhood very well, and my father's office was somewhere in that vicinity.
Yeah.
And so walking between, I'd always seen those places, and I saw the people there. But, you know, I was somehow, I won't say innocent, since, you know, bearing in mind that the first people that I was working for at WBAI included Baird Searle, Samuel R. Delaney, Tom Dish, and,
right.
you know, not a straight man in the bunch, but also didn't have a lot of meaning for me. It was a choice they made.
Well,
you know?
It was a, as I say in the story, the gay life was defined by the bars and the street, and basically a lot of the bars in the village... kids could come in.
And I did.
Having,
I was taken.
Having...
Wasn't my orientation.
It was illegal, it was illegal to serve a drink to someone you knew was a homosexual. It was illegal to own a premises or run a premises that catered to
homosexuals.
Excuse me,
really?
Yes.
So this is a law that was on the books?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Until, like, the late 60s. Or 70.
Well, it would have been shortly after that.
Well, it was an unenforceable, right, it was an pretty hard to enforce law, but it was on the books.
Yeah.
If being in business is illegal, then serving underage kids is no more or less illegal.
Right.
So that was the case. You could, when I was like 18 when I left Boston, and I was allowed into the bars there, and the legal drinking age was 21. In New York, it was 18 at that point, and
yeah.
But a lot of bars didn't want kids around, and a lot of the bird bars didn't either, because they were respectable places, and the men all wore, you know, jackets and ties and that kind of thing, And then you went around the corner. You went down to 53rd and 3rd of Lexington and 53rd. And, you know, it was kids, some of whom were really, you know, I mean, even by the standards of somebody who was like 20 years old, these were really young kids.
Yeah.
And they were,
you know,
just...
Well, when I was a young kid at WBAI in early days, I knew a lot of young kids my own age who were very much a part of that scene.
Right. It was,
and I'm
well, it was where
14-year-olds.
It's where the Ramones... Yes, well, it's what I did when I was at that age in Boston. But it's where the Ramones hung out when they were kids. But... it was a much more overt thing in New York than it had been in Boston, but it was basically the street kids who gave us the Stonewall riots. It wasn't, you know, dignified gentlemen by any means.
The village being that much woolier.
Well, it was also a concentration. One of the
and
things that a riot...
And 53rd and Lex was all, you know, and 53rd and 3rd, these were all business, high-end...
Not necessarily, no. No, there were dingy little coffee shops in there and things like that. There were bars in there for hustlers. There were hustler bars along there. I mean, those would be for, it seemed a little older. But the kids would be out on the street, and, you know, there'd be a certain way you dressed, there'd be a certain way you looked, and guys would, you know, at night, there'd be pickups in cars. In the daytime, guys would, you know, come along and just pick the kids up and take them to hotels. Or they were what were called bang and walks also, which were, you know, what that is.
No, but the name, I think.
These would be.
Explain. Is
these would be apartments on the near Times Square, although that's another dingy place. But on 8th Avenue, there were whole blocks full of these apartment houses, you know, dingy old falling down apartment houses, and the apartments were rented by the mister, by the guy who had a string of boys, and the boys would pick up clients, or you know, the women if he was a pimp, they'd pick up people and bring them there, and they would bang and walk, and you know, then they'd go out on the street and find someone else, but that was an industry, pretty much, you know. Yeah, it's odd because all of this has gone away. I mean, one of the things people who sentimentalize the old Times Square, I don't know whether it was I was getting older, but I don't think it was. The kids were getting exponentially younger. You know, it was 12-year-old kids. The Port Authority, I remember I was in the business of buying and selling antique toys, and there would be these big toy shows out in New Jersey, and my business partner and I would get up, it'd be like on a Sunday morning, and we would go to the Port Authority at like 7 o'clock in the morning to get on a bus to somewhere in New Jersey, and we would either buy or sell toys, whichever.
At street fairs.
At
markets.
Toy Soldier shows. They'd be in like college. Yeah.
Oh, these
gyms
are
and stuff.
Shows dedicated to toy soldiers?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sometimes, or just to toys. Sometimes just to toys. Anyway,
I've
we would go in.
I've been meaning to tell you, by the way, just a personal note. I mean, you know, I have Netflix. Do you know that? No, not Netflix. A Roku box. Do you know that there is a TV channel dedicated to toy soldiers? Anyway, there is.
There is, and yeah, I've seen it.
Okay.
It's...
So you knew. Sorry.
Yeah,
okay, anyway, go on.
But anyway, you know,
Port Authority.
We go in Port Authority 7, 8 o'clock on Sunday morning, and it would all be all these kids, you know, like, and it just really, by that time it was disgusting. Really, really was, and very, very sad. But yeah, that was, the Stonewall came much more out of that scene than it did out of any older, more socially buttoned down part of society, and I tried to evoke that in this piece. I mean, it was my childhood to some extent.
Yeah, but it's unusual for many of your stories to be tied to historic events. I dare say Dust Devil changes that, starting with you know, not just 9/11 being in there, but that's also hearkening or the spirit in every sense of the word of General Slocum and the Church.
Well, I do
fire.
Have,
and it ends with Stonewall because that's near the end of the book.
It's towards the end of the book, but I, well, I mean, from the files of the Time Rangers and War Child were just time travel. And there's a lot of history in those. I mean, it's sometimes transcended history, and it's, you know, things turn out differently. But history was what my father was teaching when he was a teacher, and I just absorbed an awful lot of it. One of my brothers, I mean, my only surviving brother at this point, is David Bowes, a pretty well-known
prestigious
painter.
Artist. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty well-known painter. And in his paintings, there are... Oh, there's always, you know, ancient Roman ruins or something like that show up. So yeah, we were all doused in history, basically. And it's a game, you know. History is a game like any other. And you know how, you know, there's that famous Thurber story of Grant had been drinking at Appomattox, but
yes,
that was written at a time when there were all of these alternate history stories. You know, the South winning the Civil War and. You know,
Ring the Jubilee. Wardmore was...
Wardmore. Yes, or Saki.
Yeah.
We remember for his, you know, sort of fizzly and...
Monroe was an H.H.
Monroe,
yeah.
Was a violent anti-Semite. And,
was he?
Yes, and he did two novels. One is The Unbearable Bassington, which is an amazing study of a... You know, what happens if Dorian Gray doesn't have the pig, you know, that he's just this impossible kid sort of thing that, you know, eventually just brings ruin on himself and his family. The other one is When William Came. And When William Came, it's World War. I mean, it's written like 1910, 1912. It's before the First World War, but he predicts the First World War, as a lot of people did. Not what happened, but that there would be an enormous war. And... When William came, it's Kaiser Wilhelm, and he has conquered Britain because he has this network of Jews who are, you know, undermining the British, God, whatever the hell it is they're doing, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, it's, but there is...
It's so disappointing that, you know, there are all these writers and artists who I really admire and respect their work. And
they're
then
disgusting people.
And then I have to learn, well, at least one who I knew was a very charming, nice person who had been on this radio program. And I have had to learn to separate the people from their art.
Well, you know, it's, you know, Celine, you can... Or William Burroughs, who was kind of a successor to Celine. I mean, William Burroughs is just not, you know...
Well, I mean, please, William Burroughs.
Right, but, I mean, he also...
I mean, his art was strange enough.
His art was strange and much influenced by speculative fiction.
Oh, yeah.
But there are things about him that are just... And,
oh, come on, shooting your wife, what's weird about that?
It wasn't the shooting of the wife. It was his hostility to women that made you, like, really say, gee, was it really an accident? And his son, who was such a complete mess. But I don't know. You know, it's writers are not nice people, generally.
Well, I see this is, you know, since I make a non-living interviewing writers, people like you, I disagree. I think they're interesting people. I think they're complicated people because they find this way to express themselves with words within their art and all that. But for the most part, I think a lot of them, particularly within speculative fiction, even when they are on a different political scale than I am, for the most part, you know, that would be Heinlein and people like that, they are interesting, decent people. Even Heinlein Dick and not Hubbard, you know.
Well, not Hubbard, but, well, I mean, Philip K. Dick, I mean, what were his political beliefs, you know?
Heinlein, depends on the color of the pill that he took.
Right. Heinlein was... You know, a conservative naval man of his time. I mean, surprisingly, as many naval people were, surprisingly, homosexuality was no big deal to him. I mean, he didn't care.
He's one of the first people who, in his science fiction, broke racial barriers.
But no, I don't consider him. There are in science fiction people who are, you know.
Of course, there's the 800 pound gorilla in the room, who we're not even talking about, whose movie is opening in November.
Oh, what's his name there?
Yeah.
Would you say his name? Because I can't remember. Orson Scott Card. Thank you. This will happen to you eventually.
Who's been on this show several times?
Well, Orson Scott Card, when I came into the genre, which I did, you know, like I was 40, 41 when I started writing spec fiction.
3 years ago.
Yeah, 3 years ago, yeah. He was very charming. He was very welcoming. And I don't...
He was the nicest man when I had him on the day that he won the Nebula Award for Speaker for the Dead.
Right. A lot of the awfulness of Orson Scott Card either was revealed later on or was acquired later on. I don't know which.
Well, you see, there's an interesting thing. To me, it was a revelation. To others, in fact, of WBAI, there was this gentleman who created the show, The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, Peter Lanborn Wilson, who also wrote science fiction, very popular science fiction under a pseudonym, which I don't recall at the moment, okay. But T.A.Z. was his best-known novel, The Autonomous Zone. And Peter began a print feud, on the radio and in print, a feud with Scott Card discussing the treatment of children, young male children in his novels.
Yes.
And there was quite a thing that
was a pederastic strain in Scott Card's early work that led a lot of people to think that he was either gay or a child molester, basically.
Totally repressed.
Right. It may be that, you know, that was finally he decided to come out of go back into the closet or whatever it was. But his personality, when I first met him, was a lot different than it was then revealed to be after on. But I don't,
I interviewed
him. I mean, he wasn't, you know, he wasn't Celine, who was a French Nazi, basically. You know, there are gradations of this. I mean, Orson Scott Card, by being such a target as basically he's become, is probably in the end going to benefit the gay cause.
I think he has, very much so.
Against his will, but I think he has. I mean, he was pleading for mercy here because he said we lost, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that is probably just playing possum and waiting to spring up and kill again. But
or he really does have a sense of humor that he's playing a game.
Yes, well, that could be. Who knows?
It would be in keeping, I think, with his fiction, with the personality that comes through in his fiction, that sometimes people don't realize. I mean, he has to have recognized the depth of what he was doing with Prop 8 and all that. He was publishing, you know, this is affecting mass numbers of people.
Could be.
But yes, I think that ultimately I think he has helped the gay cause. I think that the fact that
he's too good to be true.
Yeah.
As a boogeyman.
He really is, isn't he?
It doesn't matter.
By the way, we need to deal with two things. We need to sell
stuff.
WBAI.
Yes.
And we have gifts for you in exchange for selling the station. And we're selling the station to you, our listeners, because you are our sponsors. Sponsors, you know, are the people that help determine the survival of the station. That's what sponsors do. And we are listener-sponsored. And for that to happen, we need you to go to the website, wbai.org, or if you want to go directly to the gifting portion of that website. It is give2wbai.org. And if you donate $40, $1 for each year that I've been the sole host of Hour of the Wolf, you will get a copy of Rick Bowes reading his fabulous short story, There's a Hole in the City, along with a discussion afterward. And for $75, for a lucky five people, you get an autographed copy of the his latest book, Dust Devil in a Quiet Street, which begins with that short story. Again, give to WBAI.org, or if you don't have a computer handy, give a phone call, area code 516-620-3602. Speaking of phones, do you want to...
Why don't you give the number again?
The number to call here at WBAI to speak to Rick Bowes is 212-650-5782. Again, 212-650-5782 to talk on the air. And, you know, relevance is always required. Our phone lines here, we have two, all of two. And after like five or six rings, the call cycles off. So if we don't get to you after you make that call, then just call back. But please, everybody, everybody, it is so critical. This is the only pitching shift that I am doing during this summer fund drive.
You should give the telephone number that they can call to...
To pledge. 516-620-3602 to call on the air, 212-650-5782. The first number again to pledge, 516-620-3602. And to speak to Rick Bowes, 212-650-5782. And we're getting our calls here are flooded. So,
oh, my God.
So let's give it a try. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Mr. Bowes.
Good morning. How are you?
Since this is an on-the-air festschrift, I'll leave it to the Germans to come up with lovely terms like that. You mentioned the book I was going to praise. I think your best book is The Queen, the Camber, and the Seven Stories, myself. And I would like to know how you came about that book, and are you going to do any more in that universe?
Well, it's not really a universe. Those are a bunch of either fairy tale based or referencing fairy tale stories. A lot of them have female protagonists. None of them are none of them are me, basically. I had a certain number of those stories. I have been fascinated for a while by fairy tales. And I asked Timmy Duchamp if she would like to do this, and she said she would, and she did. And it was a very enjoyable procedure. It's eight stories. It's a series that Aqueduct Press puts out. It's conversation pieces. So it's short. It's about 35,000 words, and I love short books because I don't like to read. It was very enjoyable. But how did I come to do it? Your interests change. Also, there's an essay in there, A Secret History of Small Books,
right?
Ooh.
In which I basically twist things and make it seem that small books are a bigger deal than they are, because this is a small book. It said that Charles Perrault, in one very short book, Histoire... I'm not going to do this. History and Tales of Past Times. Temps passé, that's right. That's right. Thank you. I'm glad you can do that. He established the fairy tale as
a
literary...
He was a teacher here, you know.
Yes, well, I can barely, at this point, pronounce English. But possibly he also established the validity of the short book of fairy tales. And I write about that, various small books, and also that the fairy tale, originally, it becomes... I mean, Perrault certainly was male, but it becomes one of the very few genres, one of the very few places dominated by women. Most of the fairy tale writers of the 18th century in France were female. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were some males.
Like Madame de Villeneuve. And,
right, all of those characters. All of those guys, yes. And it is, in the 19th century, I mean, the Brothers Grimm, God knows, were heterosexual and male, but later on in the 19th century, with Hans Christian Andersen and Oscar Wilde, it's gay writers who take the fairy tale. And it's a... Basically, it's a form, to some extent, of subversion. It's a form of despised minorities or ignored minorities. And
the best way...
Is that true of Andersen?
Yeah, well,
we are pretty much, yeah.
Here's the thing. In the 17th and 18th century, the salon tellers, the women who ran the salon,
right.
These were the best ways to get under the radar, under the censors.
Right.
Criticize Louis XIV and criticize the whole French aristocracy. And the same thing happened in the 18th century to some degree in Britain. And then, of course, the 19th century, this leads me to I'm going to recommend something to James because he's going to love this. In September, University Press of Mississippi is publishing a mammoth volume called The Golden Age, From the Brothers Grimm to Andrew Lang.
Hmm.
Edited by Jack Zipes. This is going to be close to 200 fairy tales, including the output of the Struwwelpeter Pater stories.
Right.
Struwwelpeter Pater.
That James often refers to, and which are Struwwelpeter. Some of the more shocking tales. Although I have to say, I just finished reading a Neil Gaiman book ostensibly for children called Coraline. My God, you want to talk about frightening.
Oh, and the movie is quite something as well.
Is it? I wonder if it's as good as the book.
Yeah, I liked the movie a great deal.
Yes,
yeah. Excellent animation.
I mean, it is frightening.
Okay, that buzz that you hear in the background, by the way, are other callers.
Oh, all right.
So, thanks for calling.
Bye.
And take care. We'll talk soon, no doubt. Let's see, do that, and then try this. And hi there, you're on the radio. Oh, you see, that's the problem with our phone lines here, is that after a while, the call disappears. So please call back. To talk on the air is area code 212-650-5782. To pledge to WBAI, you call area code 516-620-3602, and a $40 pledge gets you the CD of There's a Hole in the City, and a $75 pledge gets you the book. Good morning, WBAI. You're on the radio. You see, it's that...
Nobody wants to talk to me.
You know, it's that phone line. It's not working. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hello. Mr. Bowes, or Richard, if I may presume, I really enjoyed your reading of The Hole in the City and also your last reading. I was wondering, have you ever put anything on talking books?
No, I have not. And nobody has ever asked me.
Oh, that's really a shame because, you know.
Well, he does come here and, to read, and also can be found at both the reading series of Fantastic Fiction at the KGB Bar, as well as my reading series, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and you can see him reading there on September 10th.
That's great, but being blind, I just was wondering if he did any audio books.
I have not, no, and that is too bad, and I would love to do it.
Especially with this one you're talking about, I would really love to get a hold of it.
Which one?
I know I can get a hold of the one story, but I want the
whole book. Dust Devil and the Quiet Street.
Well, I understand that Letha Press, which has brought out the...
Minions of the Moon.
Which has brought out Minions of the Moon and Dust Devil and a Quiet Street, has begun to do spoken word books. They've got a contract with someone. Now, they haven't done me yet, but that may happen.
They should talk to me, damn it.
They should talk to Jim, yes.
Because I am a producer of, well, at this point I'm an editor, but I'm also a producer of spoken word, so...
Oh, are you?
Yeah. Well, yes. It's part of what I do here at WBAI and with my reading series. And I'm also a professional editor for a major audiobook company.
Okay. So is there a website that I can go to find out more about your work?
My work? No. I mean, the result of the podcast that I edit
right.
are at lightspeedmagazine.com.
Lightspeed Magazine?
Yes, .com, edited by John Joseph Adams. The audiobooks are produced by Skyboat Media, run by Stefan Rudnicki. And I am the post-production person.
Okay, so if I go to lightspeed.com...
Lightspeed Magazine.
Lightspeedmagazine.com.
You'll find a news story every Tuesday.
One of the stories...
And there's a backlog of 40 stories there, easily.
One of the stories...
Wonderful. Great. Are they all science fiction? Or
yes.
Are they...
The science fiction fantasy.
One of the stories from my collection, The Queen, the Cambion, and Seven Others, which is The Queen and the Cambion, is in a podcast from Podcastle and is online. You can get that.
Yeah, there are actually a lot of very, very good... online magazines that have spoken word. Clark's World is an excellent
yes,
source
no.
with readings usually by Kate Baker, who is
very often
incredibly
yeah.
good. And Neil Clark, as in Clark's World, is a fine editor and producer.
And what was the last name of that? Would you say
Clark? C-L-A-R-K-E. Clark's World. One word. Yes,
okay.
Just look that up, and you'll find a lot of podcasts there. Rick mentioned Podcastle.
Yes.
And if you just go to Google and research, like, science fiction podcasts, you'll find, like, 30 places or more where you can get spoken word readings of complete short stories.
Some of them are free and some of them
are free. Most are free. If they're online, they're free.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And there's also LibriVox. Yes.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, have a good morning. And the phone number here at WBAI to talk to Rick Bowes, we have, about 15 minutes left, is 650-5782, area code 212. And to pledge to WBAI, go to WBAI.org and look for the pledge section, or you can go to give numeral 2 WBAI.org for $40, $1 for every year that I've been host of this show. You can get a copy of There's a Hole in the City along with discussion about it. And for $75, an autographed copy of Dust Devil in a Quiet Street plus the CD. And you will be supporting WBAI and you will be letting WBAI know that you like this kind of programming.
Give those addresses again.
So again, give to numeral 2. WBAI.org, or if you want to keep it simple, just go to WBAI.org and browse around the website. You will find where to donate. It'll ask for favorite show, Hour of the Wolf. There's the premium. It's not that hard. And the telephone number, if you want somebody to do it for you, is area code 516-620-3602. To call up here,
don't do that number again.
Okay, 516-620-3602. Although the recommended way is just to go to WBAI.org.
To do it online if at all possible.
Yeah, because if you call that phone number, they're just going to do it online for
right,
you. It's the same thing, and that's where we know how many go. And since there's a limited number of copies of the book, it's you'll find out directly whether or not the book is available. So WBAI.org or give numeral 2, WBAI.org or area code 516-620-3602. Any donation, of course, to WBAI is really useful. And we are in You've heard this so many times over the years, and I've been working here as a, you know, starting as a phone volunteer since 1967. There's always a crisis, but, you know, we've also said now more than ever, but you know what? It's now more than ever before. We're in deep straits here, folks.
Deep doo-doo.
Deep doo-doo was actually the phrase that was in my head. And, actually the phrase that was in my head can be replaced by the term deep doo-doo. It's dire. It's dire. The outlook for the future. And if we do make it through here, and I think that we may, I actually have some positive feelings, it will be, a surprise to all. And Rick is laughing, but it's a fact.
No, it will be a surprise.
Yeah, it really will be. It really will be. This is the situation which it has come to. It's like you can only go on the air and give the phone number so often, and you can only get so much blood from the turnip. In order to be able to get people to donate, to get people to listen, you have to have a mission goal and a product that people want to hear, and a cohesive plan. And at this point, we don't even have a program director. We need to rebuild the station, re-envision this radio station. But in order to do that, we need to survive. And so right now, we need to go to the old methods of raising money, which is asking you and look to, and we are doing this, looking to how we will do this in the future. Will we have an app that you can, you know, say, okay, I want to listen to this show and that show? How will we be working in the world of social media, new media? All of this is being looked at. All of this is being examined. But for God's sakes, we must live. We must survive in order for that change to occur. And for that, right now, we have one way to do it, pardon me, and it is the old way. Area code 516-620-3602 to call in your pledge, or go to WBAI.org or give numeral 2, WBAI.org. And for your $40 donation, you will get a copy of There's a Hole in the City, read by the author, Richard Bowes, and a discussion, wonderful discussion, that we haven't even played any of this morning, with psychiatrist Charles Strozier about calamity and how it affects huge numbers of people. And he was vastly impressed, and rightfully so, by the story. It sparked so much in his teachings at John Jay and what he deals with. So it was a wonderful, wonderful conversation. And you get that for $40. For $75, you get the book, Dust Devil in the Quiet Street, that begins with that story. Please call now. I have no way of seeing you making that call. This is not like when we had the room filled with volunteers where I can go and say, okay, how's it going? Actually, that phone number that we're giving is an answering service, and they will, you know, help you through. They will do for you the task of going to the website. That's the easiest way to do it. Give to WBAI.org. That's numeral 2. Give to WBAI.org and pledge. The offer for these books and for this CD ends in 15 minutes. That's it, gang. This is my one pitching shift this entire summer drive. And pardon me, while the CD has been the CD has been offered before, the book has not. And the book and CD combo is very valuable to your mind, as well as to the donation to WBAI. Give to WBAI.org or call area code 516-620-3602. I know that... Pardon me. I know that to many people listening here over the radio in New York City, it is indeed 2:46 and a half in the morning. I also know that there are a lot of people who are listening to us over stream.wbai.org. And what's more, there are many people who are listening to us in the future as the past, because they're listening to the archive at, well, guess what? archive.wbai.org. You can still call and pledge. You can still go to that website and actually see. We don't know what our the fund drive ends like tomorrow or the day after. So let me, but the website will still be there, not necessarily the phone line. This is another reason why we're pushing the website over the phone line. So give numeral 2 WBAI.org. And it doesn't matter if you're listening to this in the future. You can donate to the past and thereby enable the future. I don't. You were pushing me into it, Rick.
I was.
Because you're a sadist. You just wanted to watch me turn myself into a verbal pretzel, which is just so easy for me to do. And it entertains you to watch me go.
Look, I'm
totally
old. I'm old.
Ireland, mashuga.
How many pleasures do you think there are for somebody my age? Any more calls?
Listener calls?
Yeah.
Well, you see, I don't know because they do disappear after five rings or so.
Well.
So those people would need to call back. 212-650-5782 if you wish to call on the air. Again, 212-650-5782. It was nice to hear from that last listener on the grounds that she's not like the same two people that would tend to call every week.
But you did lose that man who used to call up looking for Debbie the Dominatrix.
Yes, I don't know what happened to him.
Well, you change your time, you know.
Yeah, well, that's partly it. It's the time change, and it's also, I have time passes. I mean, we've actually, Monroe Littman, alas, has passed away. So, you know, our number one tumbler. Calling us, challenging us.
So what you're telling me is that being a WBAI listener does not produce immortality.
No. No.
Oh, that's such a
disappointment. Nor does being a WBAI talk show host, let me tell you that, having worked here for since 1967.
But you're still alive.
For the moment, anyway, yeah. 212-650-5782, if you have commentary for us. But if you want to put your money where your commentary is, 516-620-3602. And we have gifts for you if you donate $40 or more. I think that more or less says it. We have 5 minutes left before we have to play our outro music. And I have no idea what follows. It'll be a recording. This is live radio. After us comes something recorded.
The deluge.
The deluge. The door's locked, though, so Max can't get in and actually put that show on. But I'm too tired to deal with it. I have to drive home. But please, please, please call and pledge. Chandler Klong-Smith is next week, and I tentatively scheduled for the week after that Kim Stanley Robinson.
Wow.
Live. On the phone, though. On the phone. He won't be in the studio. Since we've moved here, I've loosened my ideas about not doing phone call interviews. But I still only do it with people that I've met, in person. But actually, I broke that rule with Michael Bishop. But for God's sakes, it was Michael Bishop. And in fact, he was promoting the book from your next publisher.
Brittle Innings.
Brittle Innings, wonderful, bizarre.
Yeah, baseball novel.
Classic baseball novel with a speculative fiction twist that we do not want to give away the reveal.
I'm going to give it away.
You are?
No.
Okay. That would be monstrous of you to do so.
That inspires me. No,
yes, indeed. There's a pun there. People who know the book will get it, and if you don't know the book, that still won't really give it away.
No,
it's a brilliant novel. I really, really enjoy. When Sam Butler lived in New York, he and I would once a year we'd just discuss baseball and science fiction / fantasy. And I put together a list. There's a whole subgenre. And did you know, by the way, people think the word fandom referred to science fiction first.
No.
Not true. Referred to baseball.
Sports, yeah.
Came out of baseball, specifically baseball.
Fanatic.
Yeah, absolutely. The fandom, you know, we all think that in science fiction we invented that phrase. We invented a lot of phrases, including fan-ish, like fanish behavior. And firewall, fandom is a way of life versus fi-check, fandom is just goddamn hobby.
I think the term fandom is actually speculative fiction. Fans, no.
Fandom, according to, something that I read years ago, they came up with citation from 1890-something.
Right, but I don't think it would, you can always do that, but I don't think it was a term in general use. I certainly never remember it from my childhood.
Not necessarily in general use. You're right about that. But it first appeared in print. General usage probably does come from science fiction.
Yes, I mean that's an old library information desk trick. You can always find. And there it was.
Of course.
In 1803, the term, you know, like whatever.
Yeah, you see, I actually subscribe to two news lists. There are not many that I subscribe to, but one of them is the Phrase a Week.
Yes.
Which is also available at phrases.uk.co. I just love that stuff, especially the ones that nobody knows where they come to. And they usually, there's also the Worldwide Words newsletter, which is quite old, somebody who's been a researcher for the OED. And what they're always doing is they're always looking for the first printed citation.
Right. Yes, they do that. It's
yeah.
Believe me,
I love the misnomers. I love the misnomers. The idea that Saved by the Bell had anything to do with Victorians who were afraid of being buried alive, untrue.
Right.
The citation comes from Damon Runyon.
Right.
It's boxing.
Boxing. It's a boxing.
Yeah. It's exactly what you would think it actually is. But there's this whole urban myth.
But, you know, the fact that somebody has said this in 1778 doesn't mean that anyone else said it until 1910, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem with original citation.
Yeah, that's true. But when we're dealing with, you know, 16th century stuff and things like that, and, you know, Chaucer and all these various sources, sometimes that's the best one can do.
Yep.
And then they always talk about, what is it, canoe? The Committee to Assign Nautical Origins to Everything, C-A-N-O-E, canoe, you know. So something falls between the cracks, you know, well, that refers to the deck on the ship. And, you know, everything has a nautical meaning. We've got a minute and a half left before I have to start playing the outro music. I also ought to unlock the door so that Max can come in and queue up. Oh, my God, listen to that noise out there. Whatever's supposed to be on the air next. And it won't be Lister, unfortunately, this morning. He will be back next week with Burn Baby Burn Clapper. I'm sorry, Rick. I know you really get a thrill out of watching Lister come in and rip off all of his clothes.
It's the most exciting show on radio.
I have had any number of award-winning guests. More than two. You know, think that it's like the best part of coming to Hour of the Wolf.
Absolutely.
Is watching this guy prepare for his show.
Show, yes.
And well, can I understand it? So, your book's out now. So what's coming on at 3?
Well, either Lister or Lister? Wonderful pre-recorded program.
Oh, a wonderful pre-recorded, because Lister isn't actually scheduled.
Yeah, he is on my schedule.
He is.
Says either Lister or this exciting backup.
Ah, so he actually had a choice and probably didn't know. Before you do that, please don't take away my outro. Excuse me.
Right there.
Give me the mouse.
Right there.
Okay. There we go. Okay, now you can do, you see, now it's not potted up, but at least it's running so that I will end at 3 a.m. as it, excuse me, not I, but this edition of Hour of the Wolf will end at 3 a.m. 3 a.m. Dust Devil on a Quiet Street.
Dust Devil on a Quiet Street.
Minions of the Moon, also available in ebook.
Is it now available in ebook? And If Angels Fight will be coming out in October. That's a collection of short stories. The Queen, the Cambion, and Seven Others is out and came out earlier this year from Aqueduct Press.
And the website is
rickbowes.com.
RickBowes.com. I actually registered that site for you.
You did indeed.
Yes. And did the first version of that site. And then Chris Dykman WordPressed it.
WordPressed it, yes. Suppressed it and WordPressed it.
Indeed. So thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Again, my guest has been Richard Bowes. And we will actually be back with a normal, well, such as it is, show next week from 1:30 to 3 a.m. And until then, take care of yourselves and enjoy. Stay tuned for whatever it is Max is planning. Good help us. God help us on the air. But it'll be a fine, excellent show, says Max. Hold him accountable.
Well, you know, I have to say these things.
Yeah.
We are in fun drive.
Oh, that's right. And for the moment, anyway, you're actually paid to do this stuff. Good morning, everybody. Thanks again. And
thank you for having me.
Thank you for being had. Take care. Oh, yes, everybody. You can visit Hour of the Wolf on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group or at OurWolf.com. Be there.
This is Harvey Pekar, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported radio in New York. Is that okay? What, do you want me to do a bunch of them?
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Uchasha, akan duchasha. Owe dona kichama kaki lakan ombi. Owa hutopa, na hupahu yukambi. Tako skanskan ombi kile na yuha. Makaki lel. Hakan hanka takum echaki ake he om. Ona hoki chila money picte. Makaki lel hoki la mina moshikila. He om heche. Leon yuta.
Tatangi mai eraro e ave kama
Ambetu washtelo oyate dokahe wichake imachi apelo naha iuha chante washte anapechi uzapielo le unkipike he washtelo oyate hona umpi ohola oskate wichoni. Greetings and welcome, my relatives. I shake your hands with good feelings in my heart. And it's good for all of us to be here and let the people hear your voice respectfully. Celebrate life. In addition to reality from the Pacifica Radio Network, this is First Voices Indigenous Radio, and I send you greetings and strength from the east gate of Turtle Island, where the sun and the water touch the earth at once. Our website is firstvoicesindigenousradio.org, and this is WBAI New York 99.5 FM. And I want to thank you for your generosity in the last week or so, and as always, for being there and for being here today. You know who you are. Without you, we cannot continue. And my name is Teokasan Ghost Horse, and I'm your host for First Voices Indigenous Radio. And I want to reach out and say thank you to all of you who have, again, pledged to WBAI to keep us on the air. And I honor you for that, and I will continue to honor you for that. And what, again, I'd like to thank John Kane, who stood in the last few weeks here for myself at First Voices Indigenous Radio and WBAI. And for coming all the way down from upstate New York, and his radio program, Let's Talk Native, is heard in the upper western part of, or the western part of New York State. And for those of you who have missed First Voices Indigenous Radio, well, we have been traveling a bit and participating in ceremonies, and we'll continue to do that. And a lot of good things coming our way, including your ears and your heart and your generosity to WBAI, but there is a lot of good things coming. And just when we think that we're at the bottom and the low part of life, of WBAI's life, here you come as a supporter, as a sponsor, as part of WBAI's listenership, and I want to thank you for that. Today we're going to be offering something very special to you. And we're going to be talking about something that you may or may not know about cosmology. And this is very important, folks. It's not going to have to deal with the peace and war and the sensationalism of it or anything else. It has to do with the real health that's been here long before the Western world showed up in the Western world. Let's put it that way. The Western mind showed up in the Western world. And there's a little juxtaposition there going on with the types of words that I'm going to be using. But we're going to be offering you today for at that number, 516-620-3602. Again, First Voices Indigenous Radio is again here and glad to be back here. And I have to get used to speaking English again and in that way of understanding it as living in New York and in the East Coast here, I want to understand for myself that who I am as a Native person, not a Native American, but a Native person, an Indigenous and original peoples person here in the East Coast. And understanding the languages and cosmologies is a little different. And so if you would excuse me for maybe not saying an English word correctly or even a thought and a concept that we understand it in the hierarchical concepts that we understand it in this language. And I'm going to do my best here today to offer you something that I think is worthwhile. Sit down and study. We'll be interviewing Anthony Della Flora, who has been for the past three decades has encompassed everything from reporting as a daily newspaper, reporting for a daily newspaper, to running a film festival and producing television and films and screenwriting. And as a reporter, editor, and columnist for the Albuquerque Journal for 23 years, Della Flora covered a variety of beats from crime to the arts. And in 1997, he founded a production company, Taos Communications Empire, with James Lujan of Taos Pueblo. And the company produced several full-length documentaries, including High Strange News, New Mexico, and The Language of Spirituality. And Della Flora also produced programming for KNME TV, the PBS affiliate in Albuquerque, including the documentary Sleeping Monsters, Sacred Fires, Volcanoes of New Mexico. And in 2000, he launched the Duke City Shootout Filmmaking Festival from 2000 and 2008. also served as co-director, co-executive producer for the 65 short films shot during the annual event. And recently, Delafour produced documentary videos for the city of Albuquerque, and he currently has two film scripts optioned and is working to develop for two pilot TV shows for set in New Mexico. He resides in Albuquerque, New Mexico for the past 35 years, and we'll be talking to Anthony down the road here in another 20 minutes or so. Today we're going to be offering you this, and I'm going to pose some suggestions and questions to you about the myth of a Western superiority, where back in the early 20th century, at the dawn of modern physics, pioneering scientists such as Niels Bohr and Max Planck and Werner Heisenberg were making discoveries that would overturn everything we thought we knew about the way the world worked as they developed what would come to be known as quantum physics. And the field continues to intrigue, mystify, and in many instances defy explanations to this day for some people, that is. And what are we talking about? We are talking about, of course, the term discovery is relative, that the way Columbus discovered, but this is not about Columbus. The way Columbus discovered people who were already there. Native Americans had developed sophisticated concepts of how the world worked centuries before the breakthroughs of Western physicists. What they also had that Western physicists didn't were verbal-based languages suitable for describing the dynamic interactions within the world of quantum physics and the nature of reality. And it wasn't too far into the 20th century that Heisenberg lamented the limitations of noun-heavy Western languages in explaining physics. And soon math was the only language that physicists could speak in